We recorded this episode on August 18th, and we did it while self-isolating at our homes because of the novel coronavirus. Many of you may be self-isolating right now, too.
So this may sound a little different from our earlier episodes, and you might hear some background noise that we don't usually have in the studio. But that's part of the new normal that we're all adjusting to as we stay home to help flatten the curve during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Of course, the new coronavirus and COVID-19 are very much on everyone's minds, and Live Science is covering the latest news. You can find updates on our website from across the U.S., from the CDC and the World Health Organization, and from researchers around the world.
But we also hope that by continuing to bring you life's little mysteries, we can all continue to be reminded of the amazing science that's all around us.
Thanks for listening. Keep safe and stay healthy. Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
Each episode of this podcast introduces mysterious questions, and we think the answers will really surprise you.
We'll also hear about cutting-edge research in labs and in fieldwork around the world to answer these and other intriguing scientific questions.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a look at an alcoholic beverage that has quenched thirsts for thousands of years and is one of the oldest chemistry experiments in the world. Beer.
So beer is, of course, is one of the oldest alcoholic beverages in the world. It is popular worldwide today. It can be dark and creamy or pale and crisp or bitter and hoppy or sour and tangy. And it's, I think it's a delicious beverage. I know not everyone does, but I do.
Yeah, some beers I think are delicious. I might not be as much of a beer drinker, but I'll say some of it's delicious.
Yes.
But what are we talking about when we're talking about beer?
Okay, so beer is it's an alcoholic drink that's made by fermenting grain, and that grain is usually I think it initially was barley, and it's still mostly barley today.
Okay, so how do brewers take barley or some grain and turn it into this wonderful world of beer?
Well, the first thing they do, the barley has to be malted, which means that it's soaked in water until it sprouts or germinates. And then malted barley and water is then heated in a large kettle. What the heating does is it breaks down starches in the malt and makes them into simple sugars. And this produces a sweet liquid that's called wort. W-O-R-T, not W-A-R-T. So
yeah, I've never heard of
wort.
That.
Yeah. So, but well, you know, but it's essential to the beer process. So you have the sweet liquid, and then so what you do is then you rinse and you strain the malt, you pipe the wort into the brew kettle, and then you add something called hops. They're these green flowers of the hop plant Humulus lupulus. And what's so incredible about them is they're these green flowers that look like miniature pine cones. And so, but they have this very, very distinctive flavor. And that's where the bitterness in beer comes from. And so these are added, and, you know, depending on what type of, you know, where they come from or how many, that can give you a more bitter or a less bitter beer taste.
It's interesting because I think a lot of us have heard of hops, but I didn't know exactly what it was. I thought of it as a grain, probably. I definitely didn't realize it was an actual flower.
Yeah, I think I know for a long time I did too. No, I just assumed it was a grain, and that because that was, you know, the beer process is grain based, but hops are actually a flower. And so once those are added, then it's brought up to a boil and then cooled. Then the wort is cooled down very rapidly and yeast is added.
Yeah.
And what yeast does is it consumes the sugar that's in the wort. And when it does that, it releases alcohol and CO2. This fermentation process is what gives beer its fizziness and makes it alcoholic. The liquid is then put into tanks to age and for the fermentation to continue. And then when it's done aging, you have beer.
Yeah, and it really does sound like a chemistry, like something you would do on a lab table.
Yes, but the end result is something that you can pour into a glass,
right,
and drink. And unlike many chemistry experiments.
Exactly, you're right. So people might not have had all the technologies we do today, but when did they start drinking beer or making beer, drinking it?
Well, the process of making beer, it's fairly simple. You've got a grain and you need heat, you need, you need yeast and then you just need time. And so.
True.
And I think a lot of people think of wine as being the old, like this alcoholic drink that has been around for, longer than anything else. But beer.
Since biblical times.
Right,
sir.
Right. But yeah. Beer, people have been drinking beer for millennia. And so, hops actually didn't come into the mix until around the Middle Ages. So it wasn't until around the 1100s in Europe that people started adding hops to beer. But beer brewing has been around at least as early as 6,000 years BC. So the ancient Sumerians had discovered the art of fermentation. And so the Sumerians this is an ancient civilization that was founded in the Mesopotamia region of the Fertile Crescent. And they actually had a deity of beer, a female deity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this is that actually was not unusual in ancient civilizations, because beer brewing was typically done by women. So the deities of beer were often female deities, which is interesting.
It's really interesting because there's a little bit of a stereotype of a beer drinker being male, and brewing beer. Not that that's reality, but that's the stereotype.
Well, this is a shift that happened, I think it was sometime around the 18th century, I think, was when there was a real shift where the beer making process was something that, that was taken, taken over by men. It became, it became associated with, beer being a manly drink. But before then, it was something that was, not just something that women would drink as well, but that women were very actively involved in the preparation. And in fact, one of the earliest recorded beer recipes was a Sumerian recipe that was kind of a recipe, kind of also a drinking song. And it was sort of this, hymn to their goddess of beer. And it was sort of this song sort of praising her and describing how she made the beer. So on the one hand, it was talking about how great she was and how wonderful beer was, but it was also like, and then you do this, and then she does this, and then you mix this together, and isn't she wonderful, and isn't beer wonderful? And
so cool. Archaeology is so cool.
Oh, yeah.
Are there other female beer deities?
Yes.
Was this a common thing that beer was made and thought of as a female practice?
Yes. So there's an Egyptian deity of beer that was female. There's in South Africa, the Zulu people had a beer goddess who's also female. The concept, the concept of beer is not just beer being, being something that people could make and drink, but it being important enough in society that, that there were, gods or goddesses that were attached to it is something that goes way back. So, you mentioned archaeology and the evidence that we have of beer making and how beer was part of different cultures. Obviously, that comes from archaeological evidence, and
right.
It's just amazing how much of this evidence has survived over thousands of years.
And it's more than recipes. I mean, we actually have residues, right?
Right. Well, that's there are the Sumerian recipe was something that was carved on a tablet, but archaeologists have also found evidence of ancient breweries. They found residues of the ingredients that people used. So in fact, in 2018, scientists found traces of what they were calling the world's first microbrew in a cave in Israel that was 13,000 years old.
Wow. Wow. And so they found residue of actually the starches or the grains, the wheat and barley, and they found them in pits that were carved out of the bedrock.
Yes.
So like you said, it's not some high tech process. They were doing this by mashing it into the bedrock there.
Right.
And so the researchers interpreted the residues as leftovers from beer brewing at the time.
Right. And then what's interesting about the context of this, because this was a funerary cave. Uh-huh. So they were able to, right. So they were able to put this together and go, well, okay, if there's evidence of beer making in the context of rituals associated with funerals, beer was something that was probably part of a funerary feast. So they put these pieces together. together and they can see how, you know, not just how beer was made, but what its context was when people might have been drinking it thousands and thousands of years ago.
And I thought it was cool that they actually tried to recreate this process. So they they turned barley into malt, which they mashed up and they heated and left to ferment with yeast. And then they looked at the residues or the starches under the microscope, and they found they basically looked identical to the ones they had found. So so they didn't just seem like beer brewing, but they had some actual evidence.
Right. So that was in Israel, and another location where archaeologists have found ancient evidence of beer making is someplace that is typically associated with wine, and that's ancient Greece, because you know everyone of course knows about about Dionysus and the grape and the wine and that factors into a lot of the Greek myths, but. In fact, beer was popular in ancient Greece as well. And also in 2018, archaeologists found the remains of several buildings that may have been used for beer making. They found that the buildings had been burned. So they think that they were abandoned after a fire. But what that meant was that people moved away and left the buildings there, but they left a lot of the remains intact. So when the archaeologists were investigating the site, they found more than 3,000 sprouted cereal grains.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah. And again, like dating to 2100 to around 1700 BC. So they could tell because the cereal grains were sprouted that they weren't grains that were being used for planting. Because the germinated grains were specifically germinated to be used for brewing beer.
Wow. Okay, and so that's thousands of years ago as well.
Yes. So that was also at 2100 to 1700 BC.
So there is evidence that dates back about 1,000 years ago, and it suggests that elite women were brewing beer among the Wari people of ancient Peru. And so this empire predated the Incas.
Right. And then also in the Americas, there are 800-year-old potsherds that belong to the pueblos of the American Southwest that contain bits of fermented residue that are typical in beer production. And this was, I think, when this was discovered, this was the first evidence that that alcoholic beverages were produced in the American Southwest.
But to get to some of the more juicy things about beer, let's talk about flavors and colors.
I'm getting thirsty. I don't know why. I'm getting really thirsty all of a sudden.
Totally. So beer comes in lots of flavors, lots of, different colors. And there's so much variety. So yes. How can we make sense of these?
Right. Well, yeah, I know. I mean, there are some, some beers that are really pale and some that are, some that are golden and some that are reddish and some that are really dark.
And some you're supposed to pour a certain way.
Right. Yes, there's so many rules but you should always have them warm or room temperature. I know that in America the convention is to have your beer cold
and
my British friends cringe at that because it's just the kind of beers that you have in America, it's like if that's a swill you're drinking, then you want it cold so that you can't taste how terrible it is.
That's bad. So what's the difference between all of these?
Okay, well, essentially, I mean, this is speaking very generally. Beers can be grouped into two categories: ales and lagers. And most of the beers that you talk about will go into one of those two categories.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about each of them?
Oh, yes, I can. So ales are the sort of richer beers with a really full-bodied flavor. So, when you think of like a beer like Guinness, the stouts or the, kind of cloudy wheat beers, those are ales. And lagers are the ones that are lighter beers, that's lighter in flavor, not in color. Because lagers can also be, they can be light, they can be amber, they can be dark, but they just have a lighter flavor and they're crisper, and so pales and pilsners and box and IPAs are actually interesting.
Yes.
Well, yeah, it's like people who are aficionados of IPAs, yes, they will talk at great length about IPAs. IPAs actually originated, IPA stands for India Pale Ale. So you would think, oh, okay, so they're ales. But the IPAs were originally ales, but the taste is more like a lager because they're technically a, like, I guess, a lighter, crisper kind of beer. So yeah, that gets a little complicated.
Yeah, and I think for a long time, until maybe today, I thought an IPA was the sort of epitome of what an ale was. So I assumed I didn't like ale beers and I liked lagers. But anyway, I like stouts. Like Guinness and wheat beers, which apparently are ales. How about you?
I'm actually a fan of sour beers.
So does that fit into one of these categories?
Yes. Well, sour beers are probably more, they're an ale because they're usually like a sort of a richer, fuller kind of flavor. So there, I guess, yeah. So I think most sours would fall under the ale category.
Okay, so the taste is different. They sometimes look different, but how do brewers create these two different kinds of beer? I assume there's different processes involved.
Right. That's essentially what sets them apart. There are different. It's a different brewing process and different yeast. There are two main yeast strains that are used for most beers, and obviously there are a lot of microbrews and there are a lot of specialty beers and there are, you know, all different kinds of wild strains of yeast, but for the most part there are two main yeast strains that are used for most beers. And so let's start with ales. So ales are made through a process called top fermentation, and so this is a fermentation process that happens more quickly and is done at a higher temperature. So the yeast ferments quickly, rises to the surface of the fermenting wort, and then the brewers can skim the yeast off. And the temperature for this is about 68 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 20 to 21 degrees Celsius. And the yeast strain is something called Saccharomyces cerevisiae. I'm sure I am mangling that, but that is the yeast strain for ales. Then lagers, the brewing process is something called bottom fermentation. And in this, the yeast ferments more slowly at a cooler temperature. And cooler temperatures mean that the yeast sinks to the bottom. So the fermentation temperature for this is about 48 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit or 9 to 10 degrees Celsius. And the yeast strain is, I'm going to do my best with this, Saccharomyces pastorianus. And it's a hybrid of the ale yeast and another yeast species.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool. Yeah.
Most people, like, they know what kind of beer they like. They don't necessarily know, like, oh, it's this yeast strain or it's that yeast strain or it's this brewing process or that brewing process. But essentially, if you're, you know, most of the beers that are out there will fall into one of these two categories, ales or lagers, and it's all about the brewing and the yeast.
Is there a part of this process that determines what these beers will taste like?
Well, yeah, it's the yeast is part of it, but then it's also a combination of the hops and the malt, and obviously the more hops, the more bitter it's going to be. So I know that for a while there are so many IPAs that are out there now. There was like an IPA explosion a few years ago, and all of a sudden
I remember.
Yeah, and so it seems like all of a sudden there were just so many more different types of IPAs to try, and some are like, you know, you got double IPAs and triple IPAs, and some that are really trying to make the beer as bitter as possible. And not for me. I'm not a huge fan of the, I like some of the lighter IPAs, but yeah, the more, obviously that has to do with the quantity of hops and the type, you know, the way the hops interact with the yeast and the brewing process. And like I said, sour beers are, that's my jam. That is actually an ancient type of beer in which wild yeast and bacteria grow in the wort and then ferment. Then the wort is transferred to wooden barrels where it can mature for months or years. And then during that time, the microbes produce ethanol and acids, and that gives sour beers their flavor.
And so we've seen lots of different kinds of beers as well, not just a variety of IPAs, because brewers are adding kind of other odd ingredients to beers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that beers, because beers are so popular, there's definitely a real market for it. And I think that a lot of brewers experiment with, you know, like, well, how far can I take this beer and have it still be beer? You know, what can I put in here? You know, like, can I put fruit in here?
Well, it reminds me of coffee in some ways.
Oh, definitely.
We have the pumpkin spice latte or whatever.
Right. Well, there's actually pumpkin spice beer. There are all of these different beers now that have stuff in them that, you could put fruits in beer. You can put, you know, salts and lactose and spices. And so there, whenever I go out and get my sour beer, I usually, because usually the sour beers are in the weird beer section. So
with the sign weird beer.
Well, pretty much. So, that's where you get, like the cans with it. Like, they have these whimsical, the beers have these whimsical names and this, crazy art. And then you see beers that are like flavored like pumpkin spice or like, roasted jalapeno blueberry or chocolate peanut butter banana. Or, I actually did once try a sour beer that I think it was called Unicorn Farts, because it was a very nice sour, but it had edible glitter in it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So
wait, could you see the glitter?
No, you couldn't. It was so disappointing. I poured it into my glass.
Those are unicorn farts.
I know, right? I mean, you promise edible glitter, you should deliver edible glitter.
You gotta have it in there.
Yeah.
Okay. So in 2013, a beer came out that was probably weirder than the Unicorn Farts beer.
Yeah. If you thought Unicorn Farts was weird, there are beers that go even farther than that.
So Dogfish Head in 2013 released a small batch of this beer that was brewed with crushed lunar meteorites.
Right.
In it.
I think the selling point was, it's a beer that tastes like space. I guess if you want your beer to taste like space, I don't know.
Exactly.
but I guess because there are so many, varieties of beer that are just on the market now, I guess brewers do this kind of thing to make their stuff stand out more, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah. There's a Porterhouse Brewing Company makes a stout, which is that dark creamy beer like a Guinness. They make a stout that is actually brewed with oysters. And
okay, that sounds awful to me.
It does actually. It sounds kind of interesting because it's not okay. So I've never had it, but I've read about it, and it doesn't taste fishy. That's not what they were going for. They weren't going for something.
That's what it sounds like. Okay.
No, I think what they wanted was that you get like a hint of brine, but not an overwhelming
salty. Yeah.
So, and I have had sour beers that are brewed with salt, and that's actually a nice balance. So I could,
right.
And stouts are a little bit on the sweet side. So I could actually see where having a little bit of saltiness in there would just make,
And we're going to learn about that a little bit too later about why that saltiness is making it taste better for you.
Yes. But then I think maybe the craziest weird beer flavor that I've heard of is one that it sounds like it's actually painful to drink. It's a beer by Twisted Pine. It's called Ghost Face Killa, and it's made with 6 kinds of hot peppers, including the ghost pepper.
So this did not surprise me, though, that there would be a beer like this, because it seems like in this world of eating hot things, people just want more of it. They want to say they, ate this pepper, drank this beer.
Yes.
But yeah, it sounds painful. And I read a few reviews or people talking about drinking this, and literally they said that they started sweating.
Yeah.
Some people said they couldn't even taste the beer. Some said the beer tasted good.
Yeah. I mean, I think, usually most people drink beer because it's cool and refreshing. And so the idea of drinking a beer that makes you sweat seems like, okay, I guess if you find that enjoyable. But we've talked about ghost peppers before in our episode about food. And this is something where you see this, come up on YouTube all the time, where people just, they on a dare or on a just, or just to test themselves. They'll eat something
right.
Really, really hot, like a ghost pepper or, something that is almost painful to experience just for the experience of doing it. And I guess there's, you don't need to actually eat the pepper. You can just get it in a beer. So,
yeah,
maybe that's preferable. I don't know.
Maybe it's scary to me,
but there's no accounting for tastes as beers have been around for so long that there are so many different flavors available. There should be something to please every palate, but that's not exactly true. There are some people that just don't like beer at all. But why is that?
So we're going to talk about that next. We learned humans have been drinking beer for thousands of years, and there's lots and lots of kinds of beer. But Some people tend to turn their nose up at anything from a frothy Irish stout to a sweet fruity ale. And that brings us to today's mystery. Why do some people hate the taste of beer?
So even though there are all these different options when it comes to beer these days, like it's not just a matter of, you know, it's like, here's, there's only one kind of beer and that's your only choice. That's all you get. So, but even with all of these choices, there are some people that just, you know, beer is just not their thing. They just don't like the taste of it.
And I don't think I realized that there was actually any science behind this disdain for beer. I just assumed, you know, some people would prefer wine or just like anything else, you know. And I know people who won't drink beer, and it's not because they're steering clear of all alcohol, but they just don't like beer.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like I don't want to, like, if I see that, you know, if I have a friend who never drinks beer, I don't want to get too personal about it, you know, like, because people don't drink beer for all different kinds of reasons. Sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's because of the calories. Sometimes it's because, you know, because beer actually is very filling sometimes, but sometimes it is because they just really don't like the taste. So what is it? Yeah. What is it about beer that, because I've never really heard people say, and I'm sure there are people out there that, you know, they don't drink wine because they don't like the taste, or there's certain other kinds of alcohol. Yeah. But I feel like I've heard that a lot more relative to beer than other, than other drinks. So what is it that, you know, like, what is it about beer that makes it taste bad to people?
So we were talking about this earlier a lot, and it's the bitterness, apparently. And it's, you know, from the hops, from that green flower we were talking about. And it's how the brain processes that bitter taste. And apparently some people taste that more than others. And I guess it's overwhelming. They have an aversion to it when they taste it.
So how does that work? So, you know, so you open a beer, you take a swig, and then, like, what is it that's happening between, like, you know, the moment that the beer hits your tongue and, you know, and it, something registers in your brain?
So it's taste buds on our tongue. We have salty, sweet, sour, umami, and then bitter taste buds on our tongue. And they're separated into different regions. And the bitter one is at the very back of our tongues, which is right between your tongue and your throat. And each of these taste buds has lots of taste receptors in there. So when beer, for instance, runs over your tongue, you swallow it, the taste buds lock on to the chemicals that produce the flavor in that beer, and they send a signal to the brain to say this beer tastes bitter, or however it tastes. And so apparently scientists have found that there are way more bitter receptors than there are things like salty receptors. We have 25 or around 25 bitter receptors. And that's compared with like 2 salty receptors, or at least 2 salty receptors that have been found.
Okay. So now, of course, I'm thinking like, okay, so if I just like sort of lapped up the beer with the tip of my tongue, would it taste less bitter?
Or I'm wondering if it would taste different if I dipped my tongue. Because the front of your tongue has this sweet taste, and then toward the front and on the very sides is salty.
Okay, so, and then bitter is in the back.
I'm totally wondering this as well. Yeah.
So it's like, now I really want to pay attention. It's like, so if you take a mouthful of beer and you swish it around.
Yeah.
So it tastes, it's like bitter, sweet, salty, bitter, sweet.
I love it.
I feel like we need to do an experiment.
I do too.
Okay. Maybe that's something for another time. So the ingredients in the beer attach to these, receptors that are in your taste buds?
Yes, exactly. So there are 3 ingredients in beers that do this, and it's the alpha and beta acids from hops, and then some of the ethanol. And they lock onto, there's 3 types of bitter receptors that, at least that have been found so far. The alpha and beta acids from hops and also ethanol lock on to bitter receptors, and they lock on to 3 types of bitter receptors. So there's particular ones that they fit into, and that's what then tells the brain it's bitter.
Okay, that tells the brain that it's bitter. So then how does the brain then make the jump to,
oh my gosh, this is bad? Yes, I know, right? So evolution. So it turns out that
that's the answer for everything.
It turns out that a lot of poisons, toxins have a bitter taste. And so humans evolved an adaptation basically to have these bitter taste receptors to survive, so that we'd be able to tell if something was poisonous, if something was toxic. That's what scientists think has happened, is our aversion to bitter tastes for survival is also making some of us not like beer too much.
Oh, okay. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, we were talking about that before, and the first thing that came to mind was like, oh, you know, cyanide, bitter almond.
It's bitter, or it's supposed to be bitter.
Yeah. Right.
The problem is a chemical's toxicity doesn't seem to be related to how easily we can detect the compound as bitter. So we might wince at something that just has a teensy bit of a bitter compound in it, even if it's not poisonous at those levels. So basically, just because beer tastes bitter doesn't mean it'll kill you, obviously.
What a relief.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Oh, it's so interesting because, of course, you see that, you know, when, you know, young children are just starting to, you know, are just starting to try foods for the first time, there are some tastes that take much longer for them to develop an affinity to. And there, you know, there's some kind of vegetables that are more bitter.
Oh,
but,
yes.
Those are usually the ones that are harder to get kids to, you know, get kids to eat.
It's so true. Is asparagus can dessert?
Yep.
Okay.
I think on the spectrum of flavors, asparagus is bitter. I think broccoli has a little bit of bitterness to
yep.
it. Definitely
spinach,
stuff
probably.
Like endives, spinach. Yeah, there are a lot of, I think there are a lot of vegetables.
Turnips.
That they have complex. Yeah,
yeah,
well, I think turnips are just, I just don't like the texture.
Of course.
But there are some flavors that are more complex. And even if the bitterness isn't overwhelming, if there's, you know, if that's still sort of mixed in there, it's something that I think children, when they're, you know, their taste buds are still, it's like they're still, obviously sweet things are the easy, you know, they're the easy ones to get kids to like.
Yeah.
Their brain has no problem saying, yeah, eat more of that.
That's really interesting.
But then, you know, that sort of evolutionary aversion is probably something that plays into how, you know, how easy it is for, you know, for parents to get kids to eat certain things over others.
Totally. Well, so the reason that some of us sort of taste these bitter compounds more than others has to do with genetics. And so there's something called genetic functional polymorphisms, which are basically genetic variants. And they're the kind that actually, they're called functional because they affect how a gene operates or functions. And so we have, because we have so many bitter taste receptors, there's lots of genetic possibilities for variants for how we would perceive and tolerate bitterness.
Ah, okay. So it's a sort of genetic luck of the draw, what
yeah.
sort of combination you have and how much bitterness you can tolerate.
Yeah, exactly. And so researchers actually did a study on this in 2017, and they reported it in the journal Scientific Reports. And they found that one of these bitter receptors, which is called TAS2R16, has 17 polymorphisms. So there's that many variants for that bitter receptor. And they found actually that one of the variants was linked to alcohol dependence, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And so people who are sensitive to bitter in general have more taste buds in their mouth because they're more likely to taste the hoppy beer and taste the bitterness. But they also have these certain polymorphisms or genetic variants that also affect their taste of bitterness.
Ah, okay. But there are people that, you know, they'll eat bitter foods, but they still don't like beer. So how does that work?
Well, it turns out, of course, you know, bitter is not the only taste in beer. And another taste in beer that sort of turns some people off is carbonation. And carbonation also affects some of your receptors. And these are called cold receptors on your tongue. And those, of course, have genetic variations as well. They're the same receptors that might give you like the cool tasting from mint, the minty gum taste, or cinnamon. So it's those same receptors that give you that taste. But these cool receptors might make beer taste bad for some people.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And then if you have just, you know, that certain combination of the cold receptors and the bitter receptors that just, yeah, that could just make beer very unpleasant.
Well, I was also wondering, I know a lot of people, or I know some people who don't like seltzer water, and which is carbonated.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know. That's
and that has no flavor.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, except of course now seltzer has every flavor.
It has
like every combination
flavor.
Of flavor. Yes, but yeah, if you don't like seltzer, you're not drinking any kind of seltzer.
If you're sensitive to beer, you can still enjoy a microbrew. There is a way to do that.
How do you do that?
So
what's the workaround?
Apparently you trick your receptors and you sort of drown these receptors, these bitter receptors, out with other tastes. I mean, I've never tried this, but apparently maybe instead of just dipping your tongue into the beer, you eat a bunch of...
I still want to try that.
Yeah, me too. You still... You eat a lot of sweet and salty foods, and that can help apparently turn off the effects of the bitter receptors. And I guess beer nuts, I always thought beer nuts were in bars to make you thirsty, but...
Yeah, that's what I thought. But they're actually for people that don't like beer.
They don't know.
Beer nuts are for them to make beer more drinkable.
Maybe. So when you get rid of the bitter taste, you're more likely to detect the flavors underneath. So that would be a neat experiment too, if you wanted to taste beer differently.
That's kind of an interesting idea that, you know, like, so now I'm picturing somebody who doesn't like beer, but who, you know, wants to try to like beer. So sitting down with like a plate of pretzels and donuts and eating that first and then to turn off the bitter receptors and then drinking the beer. So, but I guess, you know, because like you said, there's more than just bitterness in beer's flavor. And so yeah, I guess if you can get rid of that, then you can actually detect and appreciate the complexity of the flavors that are there too.
Brandon Spector is a senior writer at Live Science, and he's joining us on this episode for a bit of time traveling. He's going to talk to a scientist who's taking a somewhat unusual approach to study the beer-making techniques in ancient Egypt.
According to Egyptian legend, the god Osiris taught humankind how to brew beer the same day he taught them how to farm. Beer was a staple of Egyptian diets and festivals. Laborers were sometimes paid in it, children drank it for its nutritional value, and priests offered it to the souls of the dead and to the gods themselves. Now, researchers in Israel are trying to bring back that original brew of the gods by reviving yeast cells still clinging to the pores of ancient beer pots. Here to discuss that research is Dr. Ronen Hazan, a microbiologist at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and one of the study's authors. Ronen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Brandon.
So, Ronen, how did you get involved in this ancient yeast revival project?
So first, I like beer. It's not the main focus of my lab, which focuses on a different topic about bacteria and multidrug resistant and phage therapy. However, I have a very good friend, which is a beer master. His name is Itai Gutman. And he told me once that he wants to produce the most ancient beer man ever did. So to do that, he took the wild wheat and he produced beer from wild wheat. So the beer was awful. You could not drink it. And it was published, you know, here and there in some journals and stuff. In one of the journals, they said, Israeli brewer make the beer of Jesus Christ. Which, of course, is not true, because Jesus Christ was in a time where already beer was, you know, domesticated. The wheat was domesticated. Everything was domesticated. It's not a wild wheat. We drank a lot of beer that day. And we thought, how can we really taste the beer at that time? In parallel, we had another project, which was that this guy, Itai, found two very old they were 2 years old bottles in his brewery. And he told us, do you want to check the yeast that are in the beer? Because the beer was unfiltered, so it contained yeast. And we told him, for most probably they die. I mean, yeast won't survive in alcohol for 2.5 years without any additional food. But he insisted that we will check. And surprisingly, we found live yeast in the beer. So we took those yeast, we sequenced their genome, we checked their phenotype, and we found very, very interesting stuff about them, which we published also. But then we said, okay, if they survived 2.5 years without food, without nutrition, what about 5,000 years? Which was a big jump. I told you, we drink a lot of beer that day. So we wrote a letter to the Israeli Authority of Antiquity, very modest letter. We said, you know, we are microbiologists and we are interested to do that. Can you supply us with some vessels, ancient vessels that you think that beer was in them? And we were sure that they will tell us, you know, it's impossible, go on. But they were more enthusiastic than us, actually. So immediately they gave us about 20 vessels. And they said, these are from the Egyptian times. They contain beer. We are almost sure. Try them. At the same time, we did a connection also with Professor Aaron Meir, who is investigating Philistines. He's excavating the cities, mainly the city of Gath, you know, Goliath. Mm-hmm. Goliath from Gath, and it's very famous from the Bible. Another archaeologist named Yuval Gadot, who's excavating in Jerusalem, and they supply us also with other vessels. Surprisingly, very surprisingly for us, we found yeast from them, and we were able to do the beer. And then come, of course, the $1 million question: are these yeast authentic? Which we work about, I think, 3 years to prove that they are authentic. One thing I will mention: the one from the Persian period was identified. Actually, the liquid was identified as mead. Mead is a honey wine. You take yeast, you take honey, and you get something which it's supposedly beer, but the taste is like white wine.
So you had these clay pots, which dated between 2,500 and 5,000 years ago, and belonged to three different cultures: the ancient Egyptians, the Philistines, and the Persians. Each one had yeast cells still growing in the pores of the pots. How did you extract these yeast cells, and how did you know they were authentic?
So first thing we did was a proof of concept. We took several vessels, modern vessels. We put on them yeast, you know, like baking yeast, the ones that bakers use, the usual yeast that people are using to make wine or to make bake. We put them under the ground, under the soil, for about 3 or 4 weeks. And we did controls of pots without the yeast. And after 1 month, we took them out and tried to isolate those yeast. And we succeed only from the pots that we put yeast in advance, which strengthens our point that probably yeast are living in the nanopores of the vessels. So then we took the archaeological vessels. We put them in a media that is encouraging yeast to grow. Growing media. We put some antibiotic to get rid of bacteria and some other fungi that are in the ground. Okay. And we did what's called the microbiological enrichment. So we gave much better condition for the yeast to grow, and we succeed to isolate 6 kinds of yeast from the 3 cultures. So 2 from the Egyptian, 2 from the Philistines, and 1 from the... And 2, actually 2, but one of them we think was wild yeast.
So, after you isolated the yeast, you did a DNA analysis and sequenced their genomes. What did that analysis tell you?
So, before that, I just want to mention that our first question was, what are the odds to find, or chances to find, yeast in the environment? To check that, we did some statistics. So, we saw that from 21 vessels that were identified by archaeologists as beer or mead vessels, we could isolate 6 yeast. And then we took lots of, about 100 samples, which were controlled from vessels that we didn't think yeast should be there, like cooking pots or, you know, small vessels of perfume and other stuff, mm-hmm. and also soil and some even plants, and we could only isolate 3 yeast from that. So it's 3 out of 100 compared to 6 from 21. Right. So statistically it looks like something here is not random. Then we sequenced their genome. And here we got, you know, it was like too good to be true, because the results were that we could connect each of the yeast to something that makes sense, that it come from a beer vessel or drinking or beverage vessel. Because 2 of them were identified to be similar to yeast that you can find in a traditional beer that is made in Africa, in Zimbabwe. Uh-huh. So when they do this traditional, they put yeast, you know, without even noticing that, like ancient people, and you can find those yeast in the beverage. The one that was in the vessel of mead was found in this stage that I mentioned before, which is the honey wine of the Ethiopians. And there we know by chemical analysis, by residue analysis, that this vessel had mead before. So this really, really matched. That the yeast, you can find it in a tedge, in a honey wine, and here we had mead, which is also honey wine. And then we had a very weird story, which was that we took as a control, we took lamps, you know, lamps that they use to put oil in them and then have light. We thought this is a nice control that for sure it should not have yeast. Surprisingly, we could isolate yeast from almost each of those lamps. And this was, you know, in the beginning we thought, oh, what's going on here? Could it be that this oil, because it's made, you know, in a cold condition and not in a boiling, could it have some yeast from the olive tree itself? So we check what, in the literature, what are the microorganisms that people can find in olive oil? Interestingly, it was, the main thing is yeast. And then we sequenced this yeast that came from lamp, and it was a yeast that live in oil.
So it appeared that these yeast cultures were the descendants of the original yeast that was used to brew the beer stored in these pots thousands of years ago. Now comes the fun part. How did you turn that old yeast into a new beer?
So we grew the yeast the way we grow them always. We gave them to our friend Itai Gutman, the brewer master, as I told you. And he made beer, but first time we did them, we make the beer in a not using traditional recipe, but a modern recipe to compare them, to see how can they make beer. And again, surprisingly, all the yeast that came from the beer vessels, they produce very nice beer, very tasty beer, while the yeast, the wild yeast, the ones that I told you, we find three in a soil, and the one from the lamp, none of them produce drinkable beer. But to be sure, we gave it also to chemical analysis, and they analyzed those beer, and they found aromatic and flavor compounds. And then what we did was to go to, there is an organization of beer tasters, same as wine tasters, so there is a, and we invited them, and happily they come, and they test it, and very nicely they gave us the same aromas and flavors as the chemical assay was, and they claimed that these are nice beer. People told us, how can a cell live for 5,000 years? Mm-hmm. So what we think that it didn't live for 5,000 years, it's the colony is living. Mm-hmm. So because at that time when they brewed the beer, they put tons and tons of yeast there in the vessel, and those yeast went into the nanopore, changed actually the content of the microorganism in the vessel, and they're still living there. Same thing as you take now invading animal and put it in somewhere. After hundreds of years, you will see those animals, like trees, like dogs in Australia or whatever. You just see that they're invading animals. So we think yeast in those vessels are invading species that still living there inside.
Now, you had three beers brewed from three yeast cultures, your Egyptian yeast, your Philistine yeast, and your Persian yeast. Which one tasted best?
No, the Philistines. And very interesting that the Philistine yeast was what we call Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is the same yeast that we are using today to make wine, to make beer, to make... It's the one that was domesticated by human. Mm-hmm. So we found that it actually came to their vessel. Naturally, it makes also the best beer.
I love that the Philistines have a reputation for being uncultured, but thanks to your study, we can at least say they had good taste in beer.
Philistines are actually originate from Greece, so they are Greek. Okay. And they're Greeks that invade to the Middle East, and you can see them in Egyptian inscriptions, and as they call the sea foreigners or so, and they come here, and they have Greek roots, and probably they knew how to drink beer very well.
I'm Brandon Spector, a senior writer for Live Science, and I've been talking to Dr. Ronen Hazan, a microbiologist at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. If you want to find out more about his work in ancient beer or microbiology in general, you can visit his website, ronenhazanlab.wixsite.com. That's R-O-N-E-N-H-A-Z-A-N lab.wixsite.com. Ronen, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, Brandon, for having me. It was fun for me.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. Today's boozy mystery, Why Do Some People Hate the Taste of Beer, is available as a Life's Little Mysteries article on our website, livescience.com.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally. It'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audioboom as part of their Audioboom Originals network.